fait pour Hollywood. That's gooey, bally, hooly Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, but no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Stacy Brewster, author of the new story collection What We Pick Up from Portland's Buckman Publishing. Stacy's a fiction writer, poet, and screenwriter. He's gone coast to coast to coast in his life, growing up in California, studying filmmaking in New York, and now writing and teaching fiction in Portland. His fiction and poetry have appeared in New South, the Madison Review, Gertrude, Plenitude, and the Gay and Lesbian Review Worldwide, among numerous others. He received the 2019 Oregon Literary Arts Fellowship in Drama for his teleplay Gargoyles and Dandelions, an original queer noir series set in Los Angeles in the late 1940s, and he's currently adapting several stories in What We Pick Up for television. What We Pick Up, by the way, is Stacy's debut story collection, and it's a very good one. In the words of fellow Portland author Liz Scott, "How lucky you are to have found this beautiful collection full of unforgettable characters, each struggling to find their way in a complicated world. These stories explore the spaces between us, our struggles to live an authentic life, and our yearning to heal. While many of the protagonists are queer men, the themes are universal and transcend classification. Brewster infuses each of his characters with such humanity, your heart will break on every page." Please join us for our conversation with Stacy Brewster, which is already in progress. Stacy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Ken.
Now, the stories in the new book are set mostly in Los Angeles, New York, and Oregon. One story takes place in Phoenix, Arizona, another in the canyon country of Texas. How do these places fit into your own life?
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, lived in California, New York, and Oregon. New York the least, but California the most, and Oregon second. But I've driven cross-country 3 times, and it was really important for me that these stories not be tied to one place. I felt like a lot of the stories were pretty diverse in terms of the experience, both in age and location of these characters. So wherever the story seemed to want to be told, that was where I located it. There's some flash fiction in that did end up making it into the collection that covered the Midwest. So, you know, you sort of had all the major quadrants covered.
Did you have any personal experience in canyon country in Texas?
Just driving through, I had a friend who grew up in the San Antonio area. So that's really the only part of Texas I had spent much time in.
Now, coming out as gay, especially given the repressive cultural environment, the homophobia and lack of support from family, is a theme running through much of your work. There are several stories in this collection that deal with father-son relationships where the son is gay and the father is antagonistic, if not abusive. What was it like for you, and when did you make the decision to come out?
I came out fairly late. I came out after college. I went to NYU film school in the late 90s and moved to Los Angeles to work in television right after film school. And it was really only that last year in New York that I really started to come out. And, you know, I did not have the level of antagonism as some of the characters that I experience in the stories. I think it's different for everyone. I think it was mostly something that just people didn't want to talk about, especially my dad. So it was sort of fine if you're not talking about it. Fine if you're not exposed. I mean, I think the love was there, and the desire for me to be safe was there. But sort of the work was not going to be on them to sort of do that work. And, you know, primarily my father, but my parents were split up at the time. So you know, it was just a lot of deep conversations. I have two older sisters, you know, that I came out to first and in my early 20s. But, you know, it's, you never really stop coming out, depending on how you present or sort of what situations you get in. You kind of always are navigating whether or not to hold somebody's hand, to drop, you know, the name of your husband or things like that. I feel like there's always a little bit of code switching and negotiation where that's concerned. Like, do I want to get into this? Do I not want to get in this? You know, I don't think the coming out process ever really ends.
You said that William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom is your favorite novel, and there's quite a few references in the story collection, especially to that book and Sound and the Fury, the Quentin Compson books. You also said it was part of your own coming out process. How did that book inspire you?
Yeah, it was actually a coworker of mine who saw in me something that I didn't see in myself, sort of similar to the professor in the story Suicide Watch. And he'd given me sort of a reading assignment, which was Absalom. And I sort of passed the test where I sort of saw the gay subtext that I believe is in the novel. Not everybody has that reading of the novel, but in the character of Quentin and in the character of Henry, there is this unspoken relationship and desire that I was always trying to decipher as I was reading this book. And I came out to my friend after reading it, and it was sort of this acknowledgement of passing the test. I had a brief relationship with him that didn't last very long. That was sort of an initial heartbreak. But that story of Absalom and coming out to them have always been really intertwined. That was the last story that I worked on in the collection, probably the one that I've been working on the longest. Trying to capture essence of that story. You know, it's a different character in a different situation and a slightly different time period in the early 90s. I was at NYU in the late 90s. But that story was, yeah, really personal and really emotional for me. So it was fun to try and capture that.
And of course, Quentin Compson in the Faulkner books doesn't end up well. He's a suicide, and that's probably something, if you identified with him, you'd want to avoid.
Yeah. No, and, you know, I don't talk about this a lot, but, as a teenager growing up gay, or, you know, knowing that I was gay but closeted in high school, you know, I was very much in a Quentin vein, very... yeah, I had plans to kill myself and wasn't super, you know, I did theater. I did a lot of stuff, sort of like work through that pain of that time period, and it passed, and I matured and got past it. But yeah, no, I mean, it's very much an important subject to me, and it's a very taboo subject to talk about. Certainly. So it was important for me to try and tackle that in that story and in whatever way I could.
Now, your initial passion, when you mentioned being in New York and at film school and in that whole atmosphere, the big city atmosphere in Manhattan, your passion there was for film. And then you worked in production in Hollywood while writing your own screenplays. What was that attraction to film, say rather than literature or poetry or other forms?
Yeah, no, I mean, I loved filmmaking in high school. My great uncle worked in Hollywood as a direct, well, first as a radio personality, then an actor, then a director and producer. And he was just such a decent guy and broke the mold of what I thought, you know, sort of this self-involved narcissistic industry could be, that, you know, it could be a lot of fun and a lot about the artistry. So, plus doing theater in high school, I really loved sort of the collaborative art forms. I loved putting on the show, whether I was in the show or stage manager, I didn't really care. It was just so much fun to see all the pieces come together from so many different angles. So film school just was a natural fit for me. that was really what I wanted to do and not pursue acting. I wanted to go behind the scenes. The problem with that was that I was very organized. I was a very sort of, I ended up going sort of a producing track and not a creative track. I was the one that was really good with numbers and logistics and making all the phone calls and making all the arrangements for my friend's student film. So I did some of my own, but by the time I got out of film school and started working in the industry, I could sense myself kind of going into this producing track that wasn't really good for my mental health, to be quite honest, because it...
Were you writing screenplays at the time too?
A little bit. But I was working so hard, I wasn't focused that much on doing other things, you know, creatively. And that's what really got me stuck. When my partner, then now husband, got a job offer in New York, we moved there on a heartbeat, and that sort of took me out of working in LA for a while. I did some work in advertising, but that was when I started. I'd actually read The Artist's Way, you know, Julie Cameron's book, and
oh yes,
and it really started to get back in touch with wanting to write, and not necessarily be tied to screenplays, but fiction as well. So that's what sort of moved the needle from one to the other.
Before we get to writing the fiction, I read that you also worked, I guess, as a production assistant on the first two seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is the Larry David sitcom on HBO. What was that like?
That was a tremendous amount of fun. That was my first job out of film school.
Oh, and wow.
There was this thing called the UTA job list. I think it still exists now, where, you know, people wanting to break into the industry, there was this job list that was circulated by agents' assistants, and you just applied blind to all sorts of production jobs. And that was a job I applied for blind. I interviewed with these producers that had been hired to do that show, but I had no idea what I was interviewing for, and got hired as a assistant to one of the executive producers of that, and ended up working with that same production company for about 5 years on a bunch of different things. But those first 2 years of Curb Your Enthusiasm were just a blast. Nobody knew who Larry David was, you know, outside of, I mean, people, even though he made as much money Seinfeld going to syndication as Jerry Seinfeld did, no one really, he wasn't the household name. So it was kind of fun working on the first season where we're trying to get big name guest stars, and, you know, everybody's passing on this show, you know, way before it became, you know, the cult hit that it became. Yeah, it was a blast. I loved the camaraderie of working in television, especially all the crews, all the people that I worked on the shows I did, even some of the personalities. But
now when you started writing fiction, was that in New York or when you got to Portland?
Yeah, no, it was in New York. That was, you know, reading The Artist's Way and sort of myself from this idea that I could only write for film and television. I very earnestly started writing novellas, short stories. I've been an autodidact this whole time. I never really took any of the sort of creative writing classes or MFA programs that others have. So just a lot of reading, a lot of experimentation, a lot of just getting it out and see what that editing process was like for me, and, you know, chipping away at that while I worked other jobs and things like that. And then, yeah, that passion came with me to Portland, where now I was really separate and apart from any of the careers that I had done before, and just really dove in.
When you started writing fiction, were there certain things, in other words, that you couldn't do in a screenplay for a visual medium like film or television?
Yeah, just, you know, it's hard to answer that question because I'm a very visual person. So I kind of start with the visual, almost like a, you know, cinematically, and then work my way around that. But I think it's mostly the interiority of the characters, the memories or flashbacks or triggering of certain traumas or things that are happening in the psyche that don't always work well in film, or can't always be done that well effectively. So
yeah, I really picked up on that, not just the interiority which you mentioned, but also describing the sensory experience, where film is basically sound and sight. I have an example from the title story, what we pick up. So the narrator here, first person narrator, is Eddie Donnelly. And there's a scene where he's in a hot tub in LA with his lover. They're both drinking and they took some edibles. Eddie says, quote, "I felt the hair of his legs on mine and could taste the copper hum of wine on his breath," which is such a powerful description of touch and taste that brought me, I think, every reader more into the scene. And then I had an example of the interior thoughts, which I don't think you could do on film, or certainly not well. It's the same story, and Eddie's now working as a production assistant on a shoot in Hollywood. He's narrating, "I was, wasn't I," the old actor said, grinning the devil grin again, the one from his TV show, "although I realized for the first time being so close to it that it wasn't a grin at all, but a nervous tick, a sign that he was anxious or wary, as though he'd breathed in the fumes of his own decay," which was, oh, Stacey, it was such a beautiful simile. It was almost F. Scott Fitzgerald-like there.
Oh, thank you.
It tells us so much about the actor, which I don't think you could get across in a film that easily, could you? Or,
you know, I mean, it depends on the actor. I mean, a lot of scripts for this lab in Vermont called Stowe Story Labs. I'm actually in the process of reading scripts for them now, and I'm always struck as how much overwriting there is, how much, you know, extra dialogue is there to explain things. So not trusting that an actor will bring that to the all that subtext and stuff in to the table. So I thought that a lot when I'm writing fiction. I'm also a big believer, Ken, that content dictates form. I mean, I get that from Stephen Sondheim. It's something that I mention a lot, but story starts to take shape and it will tell me how it wants to be told. So sometimes it will take more the shape of screenwriting. Sometimes it will take the form of poetry or these short stories. But I really let the sort of character and story guide me. I don't set out to write a short story. I set out to write a story and it will tell me what medium it wants to be in, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I wanted to focus a little bit more on what you said about some of those screenplays you read where it was overwritten. There was too much explained, too much dialogue. We always hear about trying to avoid exposition, certainly in a movie, and people make fun of the, I think there was a Mike Myers movie where he had Mr. Exposition.
Oh, yeah, Basil Exposition.
Yeah, kind of telling everything that was going on. And yeah, you do a wonderful job of avoiding that excess exposition in the stories. Really, they start for the reader without much explanation at all. And as you read along, the story fills in some of the gaps, but not all of the gaps, which I loved. They're not whodunits, of course, but there's a mystery to be solved, or at least one to ponder in almost every story. I thought of that. I recently read an issue of The New Yorker, and there was an essay by one of their critics, Perul Segal. She writes, "The experience of uncertainty and partial knowledge is one of the great unheralded pleasures of fiction." And there's this Miles Davis quote, a famous Miles Davis quote, I think, "It's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play." How do you decide what to leave out, when to reveal more information to the reader, or leave things unsettled and uncertain, as certain of your endings are?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I don't know that I start each story out, certainly in early drafts. I really tend to overwrite and then strip away. And that stripping away is that process of trusting the reader to connect the dots. And that can be overuse of certain words, that can be over description, over exposition. Or in the cases of some of these stories, I may have been trying to, you know, reach a certain word count for a submission, you know. So, you know, my copy editing skills in my day job come in really handy. It was like, oh, nope, I need to shave 500 words. I can be really ruthless. But the stories that always end up stronger when those, it's not just killing your darling. It's not just like the Faulkner killing your darlings. It's killing a lot of extra stuff that you didn't need to explain. The reader went there with you.
And I think that's wonderful that you trust the reader to do that. And I think most readers are capable of it. It seems like a lot of movies don't trust
the
reader.
Sure, sure, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
which is why a lot of the movies I watch nowadays I'm not quite as excited about. Maybe it makes it more commercial if you're laying everything out. I'm not necessarily sure that that's true. But the stories in the book, there's 11 total. And I read that you wrote them over a span of 11 years, not with the idea of collecting them. But when did you get the idea to collect them in a book?
About 3 years ago, I had a story that I initially tried several times to write as a novel, was coming through as a TV series. And I spent all this energy writing that. And the short stories had sort of over here on the side, some of them had been published before. Another five I was either sending out or were in various stages of rewrite, but I decided about 3 years ago to just print everything out, kind of format it all together as though it was a book and print it out with a table of contents and just let it sit on a shelf for a while until I have the capacity to read through it and see what I had. I didn't know that I had a collection, but it was a body of work at that point. I mean, it was the page count, the word count was enough, even though there were some stories that still needed some work. And the editor at Buckman that had first reached out to me to have, it's actually the first story in the collection, Tea Apron, Fire, Corn, Beer, Fish, first appeared in Buckman Journal's second issue back in early 2019. So 2018, I was approached by them about submitting a story to the collection. And until I had met Jerry Sampson over there, who's my editor, I hadn't really met someone who I thought could sort of take this giant chunk of work that I had done and make any sense of it. Really exciting when I approached her and asked her to read it. This was already as we were in the pandemic. So this was summer of 2020. Things had sort of halted on the film and television front. I wasn't really pursuing making that series in any serious way. And so I took that collection back out. And I started reading through it and getting ideas for the stories that still needed work. And I, seeing them all together, I was like, oh, there's a lot of stories about brothers. There's a lot of stories that sort of touch on, I mean, I knew there were a lot of gay themes, but I didn't, these themes of masculinity or these environmental sort of situations that some of the characters are getting in. It's the first time I started to get excited about it as a collection. And Jerry helped me shape it, we pulled out some of the flash fiction and some other things that I was trying to squeeze in there. I think I had the sense that this is my one go, so I've got to put everything in the kitchen sink in this one collection.
Well, hopefully it's not your one go, because I really enjoyed the book. But in addition to the common themes, there's well, we mentioned the character Eddie Donnelly, and there's three stories in the book that have him as a character, often the main character. Earthquake Weather, where it's his childhood in Los Angeles. A Suicide Watch, and that's the one you talked about. He's in college at NYU, and he has the very understanding professor there. And then the title story, What We Pick Up, where he's in Hollywood working as a film production assistant. Now, I read that you are considering expanding these three connected stories maybe into a novel or a screenplay, so you're not quite done with the Eddie Donnelly story.
I don't think so. There's a couple stories in here, both those connected stories and the one that takes place in the 1930s, The Census Taker.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful story. Yeah.
I feel would just be really fun to experiment. Again, contact dates form. I'm going to like see if it sparks something and if it works. But yeah, I'd really love to experiment and turn those into screenplays.
Well, I could see that especially. That was a very cinematic one about Depression-era Oregon and kind of a drifter leaving Portland and going to a town I'd never heard of in Oregon, apparently not too far from Salem and Lebanon, Oregon.
The origins of that story are actually rather unique, because I was doing some genealogy work, and I had this like access to one of those websites where you can look up all the old censuses, and I had the name of somebody who lived in the house that I live in 1920, so I was kind of researching them, and I found them in the 1920 census living in my house with a wife and kids. And then in the 1930 census, I found him living in a small town in Oregon, divorced with another man, a younger man. And on the census, word is written and it's crossed out and border was written instead. And I just got to thinking like, this is maybe this like queer relationship. And I just sort of started writing into that as an origin for that story. But it was just, yeah, it was just the fluke of that. And to find a census with a word partner like that, when it's two men, they had much different careers in the story that I think they like, you know, were felling trees or something.
Well, it just gives me as the reader, yeah, just a sense of how difficult it must have been to be gay in 1930 Oregon.
Yeah, yeah. I also just think it's important. My screenwriting work has delved into this a lot more, into sort of queer history, especially in the 1940s and 50s in Los Angeles, which was sort of the launch point of a lot of gay rights movements here in this country. It's just really fascinating to me that, to say, I mean, there's a sense that gay people were invented in 1969 at Stonewall, you know, and that, you know, there weren't these rich, full, interesting lives. Yes, there may have been things that they had to do to survive, but they're, to the extent that those stories live on, or that they were shared sort of generationally with people that weren't their biological family, that sort of family tree is always sort of this queer family tree that's not from bloodlines, has always really fascinated me as, you know, a writer, as a storyteller. And so any opportunity to sort of pick those out, whether it's from the height of the AIDS crisis or, you know, earlier in last century, it's always just rich territory for me.
Well, let's talk about that. The teleplay, I think you're working, is called Gargoyles and Dandelions, the working title. It's been described as a queer noir series set in LA in the late 1940s. Again, being gay was not invented in 1969. There was quite a bit going on in Hollywood during that time, but yeah, under the cover secretly. Can you talk a little bit about that project, what you found fascinating about this place and time? And I know I read a book, Scotty Bowers, called Full Service, yeah, My Adventures in Hollywood and the Secret Sex Lives of the Stars. And he was kind of like this a patron to the stars who were in the closet, including Cary Grant. Boy, there were several other big names, Randolph Scott.
Catherine Hepburn. I think some people question the veracity of some of Scotty's embellishments and stories and that. But that on top of a lot of other research was a huge influence on me. What really got to me, I mean, my grandparents were of that generation of like, they moved to Los Angeles afterwards. And cities like Los Angeles were huge draws for gay and lesbian people who discovered that there were other gay and lesbian people in the service and didn't want to go back to their small hometown. And the population of Los Angeles boomed like no other city in the country right after the war, partially because all of the, you know, Boeing and, you know, all the aeronautics and all that stuff was there in Los Angeles. But, you know, the weather, all of it really conspired that West Coast cities, especially Los Angeles, ended up being a huge home to gay and lesbian populations. And yeah, they started meeting and organizing. The Mattachine Society grows from an apartment in Silver Lake. It's actually the view on the cover of the book, what we pick up, is taken from the Mattachine Steps, which is where Harry Hay lived and where some of the first meetings of the Mattachine Society took place.
Oh, I'm looking at the cover now. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, It's looking at the, I mean, the Silver Lake Reservoir is mentioned in a couple of the stories with Eddie Donnelly that you were talking about, but that sort of history that was actually already there. And a little later in the 50s, One Magazine and Daughters of Bilitis, you know, these groups, something about the the weather and the politics, and also, you know, the influence of Hollywood, people that had come out from sort of maybe more libertarian, with more libertine attitudes from Europe and stuff, you know, moved to California to work in the film industry. So it was just this melting pot of a bunch of different stuff. And that's where I wanted to set the story. It was always a murder mystery. That's, you know, that why the queer noir. But I didn't need to mimic this sort of Chandler-esque, you know, doublespeak that they, the way they talked in movies in the day. It was really important for me to sort of feel more realistic to the people of that time. And yeah, the amount of the queer behind the scenes talent in Hollywood at the time. It's just, yeah, it was really ripe for character.
And what's the status of the screenplay? Are you still working on that? Are you trying to get production going?
It's sort of on pause right now. I wrote a pilot. I wrote a couple other episodes. There's one of the main characters is from Germany. There's this whole sort of side story that takes place in sort of Weimar era Berlin, which was also a very libertine time.
Days of cabaret.
Yeah, exactly. So inspired by cabaret, by these other historical eras. And other than episodes and some outlines, I haven't been pursuing that as much. It's mostly because of COVID and pandemic and wanting to live in Portland and write fiction at this period in my life. But it's still on the back burner, and you know, I love it dearly. I didn't write it with I had no filter in terms of big budget you know, period drama. So if there's a producer out there listening that wants a big budget queer sort of HBO high prestige gay drama,
get in touch with Stacey.
Yeah.
Now you just mentioned, though, of course, the COVID pandemic. The book is dedicated, along with your partner John, also quote to the queer elders. Thank you for lighting the path. And you reference in the stories previous pandemic, the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. How did that personally affect you, especially in losing some of those queer elders that died so tragically?
I think about that a lot, Ken, in terms of all the artists and writers and storytellers that we lost to AIDS. I feel like those would have been the people to sort of show me the path. I grew up in the height of the AIDS crisis, so I was sort of too young to know anything, but I came out, if I was gonna be gay, I was gonna die of AIDS. I mean, that was sort of what the culture was telling me to fear. And so I didn't really have elders directly in my life to sort of show me the path. So I think about sort of this sort of lost generation, the break in the genealogy that I was referring to earlier, this break of where our stories and our ways to safety, those kinds of stories weren't told. And I feel it's taken a few decades to sort of for the culture to catch up to all the lost. Not that we can ever get that back, but just to tell stories of queer healing, to tell stories of queer perseverance and resiliency outside of the context of the AIDS crisis. So yeah, I mean, I think about the queer elders a lot. I think about who in my life sort of stand in for that, whether it's older gay men or professors or people that I know now as writers who are older generation who've survived, you know, the crisis. I think about them a lot when I'm writing.
You'll be teaching a workshop, I guess, in a week on February 15th. It's called Finding Connection and Healing Through Fiction and Film. It's for the Northwest Narrative Medicine Collaborative. And it's basically about using fiction or films, narrative films, to guide us through trauma, to, quote, move from head to heart, embody something difficult, and move through it. Did writing the stories and what we pick up do this for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I know it's sometimes like verboten to talk about, you know, all the personal stories that influence our, you know, various stories, sort of give away the game. But no, there's a lot of stuff from my own personal story, either suicide ideation or even a car wreck that I was in as a kid, just that ended up really good tools for my own healing, just to get it out. Figure out a way to tell that story, make the characters survive or try to survive. They failed in ways that I failed, you know, or you know, tried things that I tried in terms of making it, putting one foot in front of the other. So,
and I think it will have that effect on the reader too as well. Stacey, again, thanks so much for talking with us today, and thanks for writing What We Pick Up.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Ken. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had a director, you could listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Stacey Brewster, author of the new story collection, What We Pick Up, from Portland's Buckman Publishing. Stacey will be teaching an online workshop, Finding Connection and Healing Through Fiction and Film, on February 15th for the Northwest Narrative Medicine Collaborative. You can find out more about this event and all Stacey's work and events on his website, Stacey, S-T-A-C-Y, Brewster.com. KBOO, by the way, is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Just a note that Jonesy comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, February 24th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.